Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Reports of Chrysler's demise seem to be greatly exaggerated, at least for now. There is a deal in the works that would delay what some see as the inevitable, a bankruptcy filing late next week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 24th of April today. Great to have you here. The old adage that a little deadline pressure focuses the mind proved true once again today. Chrysler was the beneficiary this time. It has, by the government's calendar, 6 days to get its financial house in order. April 30th is when the president has said he'll cut him off. Speculation's been building for a couple of days now that a bankruptcy filing is right around the corner, but Chrysler's investors put the brakes on that today. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is on the automotive desk in New York. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Kai.
A lot happened today with this Chrysler story. What's the latest?
Well, Chrysler's biggest problem right now is about $7 billion in debt to banks and hedge funds. And the two sides are now narrowing in on a figure. So the first offer from the government was for Chrysler to pay back $1 billion of that debt and give the lenders a 5% stake in the company. Lenders said, no, how about you give us $4.5 billion and give us a 40% stake in the company? Now, the latest offer today is reported to be $3.75 billion and still a 40% stake in the company. Now, Kai, the lenders do have the upper hand here because their loans are backed up with collateral like brands and factories, so they might actually get a better deal in a liquidation, which Chrysler and the government are desperately trying to avoid at this point.
Can we say, though, Jeremy, that Chrysler is saved and bankruptcy's off the table?
Well, if this deal is agreed to, then bankruptcy would be off the table for the moment. But Chrysler is not necessarily saved. Most people agree that the company is not viable in its current form. It's got too much capacity and obligations to its workers and retirees that are simply too big. And remember that the number one thing Chrysler is able to give stakeholders in exchange for concessions is stock in the new company. Now, here's what Stephen Gross, who chairs the automotive group at McDonald Hopkins outside of Detroit, told me today.
What the lenders are saying is, you're giving me some cash and some equity. This equity is no good unless the new company has a realistic chance of, you know, paying me some dividend or some return on this equity.
And for that to happen, he says, Chrysler has got to have the ability to shed some of its liabilities and unwanted products, which would be a lot easier in bankruptcy court.
Well, that's the question, right? Isn't bankruptcy really the best thing for Chrysler to do right now?
Well, there's a debate about that. The argument all along has been that if Chrysler goes into bankruptcy, it could be liquidated, which would be not just bad for Chrysler, but bad for 2,000 dealers around the country, for auto parts suppliers that make parts for Chrysler vehicles. But the idea here is to get into more of a reorganization that will allow Chrysler to deal with its obligations, change some contracts, and emerge as a new Chrysler. Here's what auto industry analyst Jesse Toprak at Edmunds.com told me today.
What needs to be done here is to fundamentally change the way Chrysler operates and align their production with the actual consumer demand, get rid of excess capacity, get rid of the vehicles that people don't want to buy, and emerge as a stronger, more financially healthy company.
And that, he says, would be easier in a bankruptcy court.
Jeremy Hobson in New York. We'll call you, Jeremy, next week when that deadline really looms. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
There was automotive news all over the place today. Early this morning, Ford reported a $1.4 billion loss for last quarter. In the general Detroit scheme of things, that was pretty good. And the company said it's burning through cash more slowly, so it should be fine for the rest of this year without a bailout. No promises about 2010, though. The Treasury Department said today it's given General Motors another $2 billion in walking-around money to help tide it over until the end of May. That's when GM's line of credit with the White House runs out. Ford shares picked up 11% today. GM rose 4%. Elsewhere in the major indices, also positive. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. Well, another day, another stream of economic indicators that don't sound all that hot. From the Commerce Department this morning, we got the March report on orders for durable goods. There were fewer of those orders. Also, new home sales, fewer of them, too, down 0.6% in March. And yet, economists say the steady dribble of not-so-hot news isn't so terrible. From Washington, Tamara Keith reports.
2 years ago, these economic indicators would have felt as good as a punch in the stomach. The numbers from home sales to bank profits to industrial output, they're not good.
It's all bad, but it's just not as bad as it was, and that ironically feels good.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. He says new home sales are at incredibly low levels historically, but they're not falling at the pace they were a year ago. Durable goods orders are weak, but hey, at least they're not plunging.
Go back to October, November, December last year, January this, the economy felt like it was in complete free fall. No sense of any stability at all. Now you're getting a sense that in certain parts of the economy, there's a floor. We're finding it.
Another economist, Brian Bethune at IHS Global Insight, describes it this way.
Some positive signs, a little bit of an improvement here and there.
So the indicators are like sort of positive.
They're all relatively weak. But when you add them all up, it's definitely starting to look like we're approaching a trough here in terms of the economic cycle.
And a trough is a good thing?
Well, let's put it this way. We have to get to a trough first before we get to recovery.
But these signs of hope are all still pretty tenuous. Mark Zandi says if unemployment keeps rising through the summer, any improvement in the numbers and all this tentative optimism could easily be wiped out. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
This might be a good time to draw your attention to a white paper out from the Federal Reserve today, the cumbersome official title of which is the Supervisory Capital Assessment Design Summary, although you could call it the stress test if you liked. The Fed clued us in today on how it's been figuring out which banks are healthy and which ones aren't. We won't get the official results for a week or so, but we do know this. The Fed said today that any bank or banks that fail the test will get all the government money they need to stay in business. Staying in business at all is no easy feat now, especially if you work for yourself. A survey from American Express recently found that 30% of small business owners have stopped paying themselves a salary. In better times, entrepreneurs could tap into their home equity or use credit cards to keep their businesses afloat. But now, a lot of them are simply tapped out, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Paul Langseth, a tree trimmer in rural Minnesota, says his customers are taking a little longer to pay their bills these days, making it tougher for him to cover his expenses. He says small business owners are used to making personal sacrifices when credit is less available.
Yeah, you know, that's the way small business runs. If you don't make money, then you generally cut yourself first and then, you know, reduce the business because you want to maintain the asset of the business as long as possible.
The fact that small business owners can stop paying themselves a salary for a while shows they have some flexibility to weather the downturn, says Alice Braden, the small business advisor for American Express, which conducted the survey.
The same with, we see 27% of them having a family member work for free. That's also something that you can start doing quickly, and then when you can afford to pay someone, you could say to your wife, husband, etc., thanks for the help, now I can start building up my staff.
Giovanni Coratolo, vice president for small business at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, says small businesses create 60 to 80% of all new jobs.
During a downturn, we really expect the small business sector to lead the way in providing us with the economic necessity we need to bring us out of this recession.
Alice Braden says with their flexibility and innovation, small businesses will be the first to start hiring new workers when the economy recovers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Congress was back in session this week from its spring recess. Lawmakers are usually a good source of news. But once again, the week belonged to the banks. They're making money now, or so the numbers would have us believe. And generally speaking, Wall Street has been happier as a result. To help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we have Andy Brooks back. He's the head of U.S. equity trading at T. Rowe Price in Baltimore. Heidi Moore is the lead writer for the Wall Street Journal's Deal Journal. Hello again to you both.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Andy, since it's been a while since you and I have chatted, and I know you've been on since then, but I haven't had a chance to pick your brain about the market these days. What are you thinking?
Well, I think investor sentiment is greatly improved. You know, it's just a much better tone. I mean, you got a lot of stocks that have doubled off the bottom. Earnings are coming out, and stocks are trading higher on reduced expectations. So it could be that, you know, the worst is behind us.
All right, but what does it say when stocks are trading higher on reduced expectations? I mean, come on.
Well, it means the bar's been set pretty low.
Right, exactly right. Heidi, let me ask you about these stress tests. I mentioned them up at the top of the broadcast. The Fed came out today and said, you know, here's how we did these tests, and everybody did, you know, fine, generally speaking. But anybody who did really badly, we're going to just keep on propping them up. Smart way to go?
Well, I think that it was a foreseeable conclusion from the beginning that they were going to have to do this. So it's not quite clear why they had to go through all the drama and the angst of proposing these stress tests and dragging the banks through them. And this is really what you could have predicted, right? That the Fed is saying that even if a bank has to raise money, it's not insolvent and no one freak out and nobody move and nobody gets hurt. Well, we already knew that.
Don't you think, though, that it was, however poorly executed, a well-intentioned effort at transparency and helping us figure out what's going on? Or is that maybe not the case?
Well, I think it was probably well-intentioned. The question of whether there was any transparency is still open because they're not really clarifying who's going to have to raise money and who's not. The worst thing that could happen to the federal government is that they create a differentiation between the nation's banks so that some banks look stronger than others. Because if you have that federal imprimatur supporting some banks as strong banks and some as weak, then really what you've done there is essentially put some banks out of business just because the Fed has said these guys need to raise money. That's why they're keeping this quiet, but it really fights against the whole issue of transparency and disclosure. Investors are no more wise about where the banks stand.
Investor guy, Andy Brooks, what do you think about these banks and what these results might tell us?
I think the stress test is partially an effort to say, hey, we're trying to set some standards here and be careful with the taxpayers' money, and we're gonna make sure that the investments we've made are good investments and we're husbanding resources. I do think it's hard to be fully transparent when it's very complicated and it's something brand new. The last thing the Fed or the government wants is a run on the bank and some, as Heidi said, some good housekeeping seal of approval that says this is a good bank and this is a bad bank. They can't fund out everybody if they come to the window at the same time. So I hope from this we'll see a clearer description of what the requirements are for banks in order to be viewed as good banks. And I hope the banks will be given the opportunity to get there in a reasonable time frame.
Let me try to put banks behind us for a second, because Lord knows we've all heard more than we care to about banks low these many months. Heidi, what are you looking for elsewhere in this economy that either is important that we're not paying attention to or that might be a bright spot?
How the auto industry affects the banks. No, it's...
No. Bright spot.
Well, I think in terms of bright spots, you have to be careful. Like, we can't just sort of jump into this optimism a little too freely. There's so much going on. But I think, you know, you're seeing a lot of mergers and acquisitions in the pharmaceutical sector and in the technology sector. And you're also seeing more action in the capital markets. So companies are raising money through stock, through bonds. And that shows that things are moving again. At least we have some sort of economy going.
Andy, what do you like?
You know, I couldn't agree more with Heidi's comment about the credit markets. They're working. There have been a lot of deals. The REIT sector, the real estate investment trust sector, has raised a lot of money in the last couple of weeks. Restaurant stocks have taken off significantly.
Restaurant stocks? I thought we were not going out to eat because we're all so scared of spending money.
Well, they've really been a good group. McDonald's is up some, but stocks like P.F. Chang's and Cheesecake and Chipotle have just been on fire the last couple of weeks. So I think that might signify that the consumer's in better shape than we've given them credit for.
Andy Brooks at T. Rowe Price, Heidi Moore at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, finding ways to help the hardest hit.
11.4% of all seniors are at risk for hunger in this country. That's 5 million people at risk for hunger.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 119 points today, 1.5%, 8,076 at the bell. The NASDAQ gained 42 points, 2.5%, ended the day at 1694. The S&P 500 climbed 14 points. That's about 1.6%, finished at 865. For the week, the Dow dropped 0.7%. The S&P 500 slid 0.4%. The NASDAQ ended higher, though, for the seventh week in a row, up 1.3%. The Cheesecake Factory that Andy was just talking about baked a 19% gain today. American Express charged up more than 20%. Steak and Shake rose almost 20% after reporting sizzling quarterly sales and unexpected profits. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The 30th Annual Sports Emmy Awards Ceremony takes place in New York. The National Academy of Sciences holds its annual meeting in Washington. President Obama is slated to speak. And a time to turn your attention to the stars, the sparkly ones in the sky. Astronomy Week begins. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Even before the economy went down the tubes, public and corporate pension programs in this country were in deep and serious trouble. Airlines, automakers, and a whole slew of smaller companies had either given up on their pension plans or handed them over to the government agency that tries to make retirees whole. Since the market crash last fall, though, it's only gotten worse. By some estimates, pension plans have lost about $2 trillion over the past year or so. And the businesses and local governments that run those plans are having to come up with billions of dollars in new or unanticipated contributions at the worst possible time. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Debbie Elmore's goals for her retirement are pretty simple.
I do not want to end up being a burden down the road.
Elmore is a third-grade teacher in Fayette County, West Virginia. She doesn't want a beach house and isn't planning elaborate tours of Europe. All she wants is
to be able to retire with some dignity.
And because Elmore's part of West Virginia's state pension plan, she doesn't have to worry. Even though her plan and hundreds of others are underfunded, West Virginia and its taxpayers guarantee Elmore's retirement benefits. The catch, though, is that public pension plans around the country lost more than $1 trillion during the financial crisis, according to the Center for Retirement Research. And some plans in poorer communities may need a bailout.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth Keller is at the Center for State and Local Government Excellence.
They will probably need help from their state governments, if not the federal government.
Even well-run local governments are hurting. Huge unexpected pension payments are coming due as tax revenues fall and schools and health programs face cuts. The pension crunch is hitting businesses, too. Private pension plans lost almost $1 trillion themselves in the stock market. Federal law requires businesses to replace all that cash in just 7 years.
Let's say you're a company that's doing reasonably well in this downturn.
Steve Dobro is president of the American Society of Actuaries and Pension Professionals.
You're struggling to meet a payroll. You're trying very hard to manage your cash flow. And then your actuary taps you on the shoulder and says, oh, you remember those millions of dollars you lost in the U.S. stock market in your pension investments? You now have to come up with 15% of that amount of money right now in addition to your regular pension contribution.
One of Dobro's clients, who owns a fruit distribution company with just 15 employees, is facing a $500,000 mandatory pension contribution this year.
Now, I don't know very many small businesses that can afford a hit like that all in 1 year in a profitable year.
In some cases, pension obligations could push companies into bankruptcy. And Jim Klein at the American Benefits Council says the federal government should relax pension funding rules given the scale of this crisis.
It's an issue about jobs.
Klein argues if businesses have to funnel more than $100 billion a year into their pension plans, that could kill economic growth. He says businesses want to fully fund their plans, but they need a bit more time to get there. And Elizabeth Keller at the Center for State and Local Government Excellence says public pensions need time as well.
I think if we take a long view, and by long view I mean not 5 years, but 20 years, I think that we will smooth this out over time.
But a $2 trillion hole could be hard to fill. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The through line of this recession so far has been unemployment. The millions of people have lost their jobs or had their hours cut back. But a down economy doesn't really care why somebody's not working. So those who can't work because of age or illness are getting hit too. And the charities that a lot of them depend on for things like food or shelter are being squeezed, which in turn leaves big holes in some already fragile safety nets.
Well, welcome to St. Vincent Meals on Wheels.
At 9 in the morning on a Wednesday, Daryl Twerdahl standing at the back of a nondescript building in downtown Los Angeles.
This is our loading dock where you can see we have about 34 vans that go out throughout the city every day, delivering about 4,300 meals a day.
Twerdahl is the executive director of the St. Vincent's Meals on Wheels Foundation. As we go inside, through a pair of swinging doors, there's a huge industrial kitchen swarming with both volunteers and paid contractors.
This is our hot tray side. Over on the other side is where we prepare cold suppers.
Workers plump vegetables, meat, and milk cartons down onto plastic trays and push them down the assembly line. Each one has a special tag that lists dietary restrictions, no juices or low sodium. Unlike a lot of programs, this one offers diet-specific meals for clients who are mostly ill or elderly.
This gentleman on Route 16 is not to get the ends of the bread. He has no teeth. So, you know, we really try. We really try to pay attention.
It is a pretty impressive operation, and growing, too. St. Vincent's has taken on more clients as other Meals on Wheels programs in Southern California have cut back. But budgets are tight. The federal government and private donors have less to give. And still, in this economy, the need is only increasing. St. Vincent's recently picked up a route in South L.A. where clients had been waiting more than a year for assistance. All of those clients were over 80 years old.
The waiting lists are growing, and, you know, 11.4% of all seniors are at risk for hunger in this country. That's 5 million people at risk for hunger. So we're only serving 4,300 of those people.
Out back, some of the vans that will serve those 4,300 people are packed up and ready to go. Assistant Director Frank Kolbash invites us into his. He's got a light load today, mostly because we're here. Five stops distributed over central Los Angeles.
We're going to Fedora.
833 South Fedora.
Yep.
Timothy Alario prefers to come out and get his meals, which explains the honking. Alario is 51 years old. He looks 65, though. He's got cancer, and that makes him visibly weak on his feet. Vertigo makes walking to the grocery store difficult. Frank Kolbash hands over two trays, lunch and dinner. Today, they come with a treat, a slice of Angel food cake, since it's Alario's birthday.
I can't emphasize how important this particular program is for someone like myself, okay? I live on a very fixed income. I don't even make $1,000 a month, you know? My rent's $600.
So what would happen if you didn't get this program?
I'd be hunting for food 2 weeks of the month.
The meals cost St. Vincent's about $6 a piece. Recipients pay what they can. The program covers the rest with donations and grants. But Frank Kolbash says the real reason St. Vincent's has stayed open is the program's founder, Sister Alice Marie Quinn.
You know, there's never any doubt in her mind that the program will be taken care of.
I find Sister Alice Marie keeping an eye on things from her office back behind the kitchen. It's decorated floor to ceiling with angels, which explains why, perhaps, every time the phone rings with a new client request, she always says yes.
You know, you can't say no to somebody who's hungry. And our founder was St. Vincent de Paul, and he said, you know, he was the saint that never said no. And so I told God, I said, you take care of the money, I'll take care of the work.
I got to tell you, it's a crazy way to run a business, right?
No, it is crazy, but that's God's way. A lot of people think he's crazy.
No matter who's keeping the books, St. Vincent's and programs like it are going to need more than just faith to carry them through. We took some pictures while we were out there if you want to see what a Meals on Wheels program looks like. They're at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
For half an hour every day, we work to bring you the really big stories on business and the economy on this program. For the next minute and a half, though, Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan are going to do something completely different, quiz the Marketplace staff about the week's lesser-known news, the kind of thing you might talk about at a dinner party.
Amy Scott, New York Bureau Chief, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Barron's has a story this week about all the bargains out there right now for private jets.
Wow.
That's right. So whether you want to...
There's a silver lining in every economy, Amy.
Well, indeed. Right now, a used Gulfstream GV is going for like $28 million.
At last. What are they taking in trade on, like a 2000 Corolla? It has two airbags.
Steve Henn, senior reporter at Marketplace. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Chris Dodd's fundraising.
Boring.
Yeah, well, this is Washington, so low bar.
Okay.
Dodd's facing this really tough race this year. He raised like more than $1 million in the last 3 months, but only $4,000 from residents of Connecticut. Just five people who he represents actually gave him money. What's amazing to me is the percentage. $4,000 out of $1 million, that's like 99.6% of his money. He's like the ivory soap of political fundraising.
But not so pure.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace, go.
Well, it's more bad news for the newspaper industry.
And as a journalist, that's just what I want to hear, but continue.
I know. Happy Friday, Rico. Well, the largest newsprint maker in the world, called Abitibi Bowater, just filed for bankruptcy.
Is Abitibi Bowater one word?
Yes, it is.
Maybe they went out of business because they used all the newsprint, just printing up incredibly long business cards.
That's true. As a conservation measure, they should have shortened their name.
There's a reason why IBM is still in business.
That is just a taste of what Brendan and Rico can do. You can find a link to their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download on our website. It's marketplace.org. The name of this radio broadcast is just Marketplace. It's from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 119 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ rose 42 points, 2.5%. The S&P 500 gained 14 points, 1.2% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, another way to think about CEO compensation.
You question things and ask, well, why do you have a helicopter? What exactly is the business purpose of this helicopter? And perhaps that money should be being used for other purposes.
Perhaps. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.